How aware are you?
You're probably aware that mammograms are a great way to detect breast cancer.
And that regular, moderate walking can be good for heart health.
But are you aware that the fifth most common cancer in the United States is uterine cancer?
And that the average age at diagnosis is 60?
Well, I definitely wasn't when I was diagnosed with endometrial cancer at the age of 32.
And that's exactly what inspired this podcast.
We are Mary and Alex, a mother-daughter duo engaged in multi-generational dialogue surrounding subjects related to gynecologic cancer, women's healthcare, and various other topics that impact our daily lives.
We are
Down There Aware.
Thanks for joining us again for another episode of Down There Aware. Today, we're going to be discussing terminal diagnosis and some more sensitive topics. And so I'm going to have Mom introduce our guest.
Yes, we are really excited to have Dr. Randall Bradley with us. Let me tell you just a little bit about him. He is the Ben H. Williams Professor of Music, a professor of church music, and director of the Church Music Program and the Center for Christian Music Studies at Baylor University. And full disclosure, he is a dear friend of mine. I met Randall through his high school band director, who I was dating at the time. And we've been able to carry on a really wonderful friendship for so many years. Randall went on to get married. He was married to Brenda for 36 years. He has two adult children, Hannah and Isaac, and is just doing awesome things in Waco, Texas, and around the world because he's involved in ministry as well. I know he has a heart for Kenya, and we can get into a lot of that. I also want to be sure that our listeners know in the show notes, we'll put all the links for the involvement that Randall has in Kenya and other missions. And Randall's also an author. So we want to put links to his books in the show notes and a few other things. So welcome, Randall, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's delightful to be here.
How about if we start to kind of put things in context for our listeners? Back at April of 2019, could you tell us a little bit about what led up to that time? And we can, that might give a little backstory.
Sure. Well, before April of 2019, Brenda was an incredibly healthy person, we thought. She was a person who ran most every day. She did yoga almost every day. She was the healthiest person I thought I knew. And so all of her cancer diagnosis was such a huge surprise, but she had been having some pain in her abdominal area for about 4 or 6 weeks or so. And she went to a outpatient clinic and they said, well, you're constipated. You're constipated. So we said, you know, she always ate really healthily, but we said, hey, you know, we're getting older. We're in our late 50s, you know, things change. So she started taking Miralax and that didn't do anything to the pain. So a couple of weeks later, she went back to the doctor and they said the same thing, but they said, we'll go home and double the Miralax. Mm-hmm. Well, it got worse, and we were on spring break of that year. We were visiting family in Alabama, and her pain got more intense. And I said, Brenda, when you get back, you've got to have an appointment first thing Monday. Well, she did that, and they said the same thing. You're constipated, but let's do a CT scan just to make sure nothing else is wrong. So they called and scheduled it a couple of days later. Well, she had a class. She was an English teacher at the community college. And so as teachers do, she rescheduled because she had a class. And about 10 days later, she had the CT scan. And I didn't really think anything about it. And the day of the CT scan, it was not even on my mind because I just thought it was something normal. Well, within an hour and a half or so, the doctor called her and she eventually answered her phone. And he said, you have a mass on your pancreas. And this does not look good. She was on the Baylor campus taking a Swahili class that she was taking all year. And she called me and said, I'm on campus and I'm outside your building. If you got a few minutes to visit. So she came up and told me the diagnosis. Wow. And then we both called the doctor just to kind of, for me to affirm that, yes, she really heard this right. And all of that. And our life changed over just those few minutes. Within the week, she had, they had done some more exploratory tests to see if they could get down into the pancreas. Turns out it was completely blocked and there was only the size of a pinhole. So they really couldn't explore. And the pancreas was, the tumor had wrapped itself around her small intestine, which is why she was constipated. And by that point she was, had already lost some weight and what have you. Fortunately, we got in to see a surgeon in Dallas a day or so later. And when we got there, she was already dehydrated, which we didn't know. And he said, I can't send you home. You know, you're receiving no nourishment. You're not able to pass anything. So 2 days later, she had a surgery to bypass her pancreas. And then they were able to confirm that the tumor had indeed, that the tumor was also, the cancer was also in her liver and there were spots on her lungs. So it was,
wow.
It was stage 4 pancreatic cancer. And we were not given any real hope for a long life. The prognosis was that she would have like 3 to 9 months to live. And we talked with an oncologist and what have you. And eventually the surgeon kind of encouraged us not to do treatment. But when we met with an oncologist, he said, if you don't do surgery or if you don't do treatment, not surgery, if you don't do treatment, that you probably have about 4 weeks, good weeks, and then you'll have about a 4 week decline and you'll be gone by the end of June. And that was already in May, early May. So we decided we needed more time than that. So she began to take treatment and that did give her some extended time. And she eventually passed on January 1st of 2020, which was just almost 9 months exactly from the time she was diagnosed.
So it was really aggressive. And Anne had really gotten to stage 4 without a blink of an eye, really.
Yeah, we really had no warning signs until about, 4 to 6 weeks. But even those warning signs were very mild. But then within a few days, it got to be really, really intense.
Well, and that's why we really want to focus on this podcast on symptoms that maybe seem like nothing, but they definitely need to be investigated early on. And clearly you all did the best you could and it still was not a great outcome, but there are some things that can be caught early. So we really do advocate for, if you feel a pain that is, unusual, even a little bit. And if you go to a doctor and he says constipation, you go to another doctor. And those things are just so important. And that's why we wanted to bring your story to light, along with the fact that I was able to be in touch with you long distance, as many of your friends were, because you were so open and honest about your journey. And I think that's really important for our listeners too. You said at the beginning, they didn't really give you a lot of hope. And so when you're faced with that news, I know you and Brenda and your children did a lot of positive things in that period of time. So can you kind of walk us through some of those?
Sure. Well, even the very evening after Brenda was diagnosed, I had to go that afternoon. I had to go with a choir that I directed Baylor for a small concert for a group of people on campus that I'd committed to a couple of years early. So I couldn't just go right home. And I got home and Brenda had gone by the grocery store and she had prepared a beautiful candlelight meal that very evening. And she was just already determined to be positive in this situation, as was I. Well, we talked about what are we going to do? How are we going to tell people? We started getting in touch with our kids and wanted to tell them first. And then Brenda's mom, and her mother, by the way, is 93 and has lived a long, long time, but wanted to get in touch with family. But we started that very evening saying, okay, you know, we've got this to deal with. This does not look good. How are we going to deal with this? What are we going to do? And a couple of big things that we determined that very evening and the next day was that if this meant death, and certainly it meant a long haul of treatment, that we were going to live this time as we had lived our life already, which was positively and actively. And so a few days later, we did meet with a friend who is a surgeon at his home, and he was able to access Brenda's scans. This was on Monday after she'd been diagnosed on Friday, but before she had further tests. And he said, you know, they're not telling you that she's not going to live, but basically Brenda is not going to live a long time. And this is not going to be treatable. He was very, very frank. And we said, we want to know everything you can tell us. So we've talked some more, and then we came up with kind of the idea that Brenda wanted to die as she had lived, which was living big and full and bold. And then the other big decision that we made was that we were not going to live in a vacuum and in some, we're not going to get in the corner and pity ourselves and not share, that we were going to find ways to be as open and vulnerable and to allow our friends to come alongside us in every way, because we realized we needed them, but we also realized that they needed to be a part of this experience. So those were some sort of overall ground rules, I guess you might say. Mm-hmm. So the very, Brenda had surgery exactly a week later on a Friday. And then the next weekend was Easter. Mm. Brenda got out of the hospital on Wednesday, and our kids were just determined that we would have a big crowd of people for Easter. So we had already invited all these people before Brenda got sick, and we had about 50 people at our home for Easter. Wow. Mm. And Brenda was obviously not well, but she was determined and went to church that Easter Sunday, which was just like 9 days out of surgery. And we just determined to do everything that we could. So some other big things that we did during the time was we had been to Kenya a number of times with our children and through their growing up time, and have a nonprofit that supports girls in Kenya. And Brenda determined that she wanted to make one more trip to Kenya. And so our friends rallied around that, and we found a date, you know, between the chemotherapy and what have you. We talked to the oncologist, and he said, I've never had a chemotherapy patient go out of the country. And certainly not somebody with stage 4 pancreatic cancer. But he said, if you want to go, we're going to make this happen. Mm-hmm. And so he was just all in, and we worked the treatments out where she would stop at a certain point and what have you. So we went to Kenya, and she had 14 great days and was not sick to the point where she couldn't participate in things until the very, very last day when we were on the way to the airport. She got pretty sick, and then came home and had a treatment right after we got home, the very next Monday after we got home late on Saturday night. And then that weakened her system so much that then she had a digestive parasite, mm-hmm. and that sent her to the hospital. And she ended up losing about 10 more pounds mm-hmm. in that process. And one of the markers for her surviving was keeping her weight up. She was only about 125 pounds when she was diagnosed. And then she lost about 10 pounds in the hospital, and then now another 10 pounds. Mm. So weight was one of the things that we were trying to keep up. But Brenda said, you know, this was all worth it. I'm glad I went. I wouldn't do it differently. There were other things that we did. Brenda had always wanted to publish a book of her poetry. Mm. And so she began just within a day or two looking at options and calling friends around the country, other poets that she knew that had published books, and to find out, you know, what's the most expedient thing she could do to get a book published. So she started on that. She got her poetry out to a bunch of colleagues in the English world, and they started reading and evaluating which ones were best. And she published this book of poetry that came out in the early fall. The other big project that Brenda wanted to do was do a book of recipes, because she was a great cook and had entertained and been, our house was always the kind of the place of hospitality. So Brenda wanted to do this recipe book, and she got started on that and involved a team of friends and what have you. But by the time she was really putting it together, her mind was beginning to get cloudy a bit from so much pain medication. And we were already well into October and into the 1st of November. So I promised her that if she would not work on the cookbook, that when she passed, that I would work on the cookbook, and I promised her I would get it out and we would make a good run of it. So I did. And the year after Brenda died, I finished the cookbook, and with the help of a host of friends, and we got it out. And then we used that money from the cookbook. I purchased the cookbook and then sold it, and we gave all the money to a scholarship fund that is now fully funded in her name for English majors at her community college.
So I just wanted to mention both of those, the cookbook Bread for the Journey and the book of poetry, A Few More Minutes. We'll put links on our webpage to both of those. I have them both and I love them both. So we want to be sure to get the word out for people who might want to get those as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, the poetry book and really the other book as well, the cookbook, both of those will give you kind of a snapshot into Brenda. The cookbook is not just a book of recipes. It's also a book of stories, and it has lead-ins to a lot of the recipes and what, when we prepared some of these and how they were stories around them and the people and what have you. But the book of poems will give you quite an insight into Brenda's life. And for instance, there's a poem in the book, and I can't remember the name right now, but it was written 3 days before she was diagnosed. And the poem talks about, it says, suppose this pain in my tummy or something like that, this pain is more than just a pain. What if I never see another blue bonnet blooming? What if spring is, I never see another spring? And she, so there was some level of a premonition of sorts that she knew that this was terminal. And she was in her Swahili class when the doctor called, and she didn't answer the phone, even though she saw it and saw it was the doctor. And so I thought, well, you know, she just didn't want to interrupt the class or something like that. But a friend of mine recently said, suppose she knew this was bad news and she knew this was the last class that she would ever be in. And she didn't want it disturbed. And I think that's probably likely, because she never did get to go back into the classroom again. She never got to teach another day, and all of those things. But
I think in listening, I mean, I knew most of what you shared. And I think the takeaway is you had this deliberate sit down and made decisions about really important things. And then those that laid a groundwork upon which you made other decisions as, you know, she continued to decline, but that was kind of the foundation for how she got to choose how she was going to go through that journey. And well, you both did. And I think that's so important. And a lot of times we don't take the time to sit with it and say, okay, this is how I'm going to do it. It's going to happen. So this is how I'm going to do it. That to me is so encouraging and so inspiring, because you do have some control.
Yes. You have a lot of control, actually. And that was the level of agency that you have is very significant. We talked to our children in the same sort of way. We all talked about what's this going to be like for mom to die? How are we going to respond? What are our plans? And Brenda and I had those conversations, not every day by any means, but every week or so, every few days. And some of those were always incredibly meaningful. But at one point, a few weeks before Brenda passed, she said to me, "I think you have gone as far with me as you can go. And I think I have to go the rest of this journey by myself."
Wow.
And that was as the hospice people were telling us there would be this separation that would start to happen. And that was exactly what was beginning to take place at that point. There were other things. We didn't hide the idea that we needed to get our finances in order. And we both met with her HR people at her school to say, you know, how long can she be on leave? And what does it look like financially? And what are the options here? We immediately, by the end of the summer, we had made appointments with her retirement account people to decide. We didn't have any idea, you know, whether I could have benefits or any of those things. So we immediately got on all of that. And Brenda worked on her own plan. And, you know, what's the best way? Do you retire? Or do you take death benefits? Or do you take health retirement? There's so many options that you can take at a moment like that. But which one is the better option? With Brenda's knowledge and both of us, we actually got all of her life insurance policies together. We looked at all of that. And what does that look like? And how does that affect my future? And so she was a part of all that process. When it came time to talk about her funeral, at some point, you know, in the fall, a few months before she passed, I said, "What do you want at your funeral? And who do you want to speak? And what do you want music to be like?" And all these things. And she said, "You know, I really, you're the musician, you're the worship planner. I want you to plan that. You would do much better than I." But we eventually talked, like, who do you want to represent you from your school? And who would you like to say something about you? And who are these people and what have you? So she saw her entire funeral plans and okayed them. I started working on her obituary at one point, and she proofed it and worked on it herself and updated things and did all the punctuation. And so when she passed and we were doing all the forms of her obituary, which some would be smaller and larger and different, whatever, I said to everybody, "Do not change any punctuation. This punctuation is correct and we would mess it up. So don't assume you're correcting something," because Brenda had worked on all of that herself and she knew what it was going to be like.
That had to be a comfort for the family that she had all that input. Didn't mean to interrupt you, but.
No, it was. And she started a book where she was writing notes to the kids, and she got probably 15 or 20 pages in about writing some of her thoughts to the kids. And, but she was very detailed about a lot of things. For instance, she had written poetry for years and there were just poems everywhere. But I found a note after she passed in the front of a book, and she said, "These are all the poems that I wrote once I was diagnosed with cancer."
Oh.
And she said, "All of my poems are in," and she told what file on the computer. And she said, "Everything is there, except there are a few scattered poems in the secretary by the front door."
Wow.
And then she says, "So if anyone ever wants them, you'll know where they are."
What a help to you.
And, so there were just all sorts of little hints and notes that she left around that helped us navigate. But I did another thing, and this is a prep for death too, was I told her over and over and over, "Do not clean up your stuff to die." You know, because she said, "I really need to go through my things and I need to do this and they just sort my clothes and, you know, all these things." And I said, "Absolutely not. Your time is not going to be spent on that. I have the rest of my life to sort out your things, and that will be part of my therapy." And so she didn't. She just literally walked off and didn't walk off. She went away. She went away and left it. And that's as it is.
That was great advice from you. It really was, to spend her time wisely and more meaningfully, because you're right. You've got all the time in the world to deal with that. Right.
Yeah. And another very interesting thing that occurred was several months after Brenda passed, really just about 8 or 9 months ago. One evening I was looking for something unrelated to Brenda, and I was just looking through drawers, and I found a whole bunch of, well, I knew she'd kept a journal for most of the 40 years that I knew her. Mm. And so I found a stack of journals, and I was reading one of the journals, and it was talking about some difficult times in our family. And she was saying in the journal, you know, I'm just not sure what's wrong with Randall, and he's not been himself lately. And, you know, this about the kids and what have you. And I just got incredibly sad that, you know, I'd read all of this. So a few days later, I had lunch with one of my dear friends. And I told him about it. And I said, this really disturbs me a bit. And he said, well, I see this as hopeful. He said, Brenda had 9 months and plenty of time at home by herself, and she could have thrown away anything that she didn't want anybody to read. Mm-hmm. And he said she had plenty of time to prepare for that. But he said, my gut from knowing Brenda is that she didn't feel the need to throw those things away because she trusted you to understand the context of how and when she wrote that. And that was not the full story. So just simply say that, because I think sometimes, you know, we discover the things, you wish your life, you wish your marriage had been perfect, and you wish your every response that you ever gave in this relationship had been beautiful and sensitive and kind. And that isn't the way it is. But we even decided we would live the way we had lived. She would die as she had lived. And maybe one last example of that is there was a moment when, and this is a bit personal, but there was a moment when Brenda's sister was visiting us, and Brenda and I got, this is probably, you know, in, it was in September, so just 3 or 4 months before she passed. And Brenda and I got in a pretty significant argument about something. And we were always very open and didn't hide our feelings and what have you. And we got in this argument, not, you know, horrible, but just something. And anyway, so Brenda's sister interceded and really was angry with me for arguing with Brenda at a time when she was ill and what have you. Well, I was very annoyed about being somebody jumping in on our relationship. Well, anyway, I went outside to just cool a little bit and what have you. And in a little bit, you know, Brenda's sister came and she apologized. But she said, Brenda told me that you all are going to live your life the way you want to live it, and it's your relationship, and we don't need anybody stepping in to deal with our relationship. And this is us. And if you're going to be here, you do not say anything else about how we do our life. Mm.
Wow.
And so I think that speaks to the fact that you're going to be angry in this time, and there are going to be times when your pressures are high, but you live in the way that you've lived. Mm-hmm. Brenda also, that fall, you know, the big question was, do I take family leave and spend the fall at home taking care of her? And we didn't choose to do that. And I say we, because Brenda said, I want to see you in my last days as I have loved you, which is you doing the things that you love. And she said, that's why I fell in love with you, because of who you, as much as who you are with other people as who you are with me.
Yeah. Mm.
And I want to know that you are going and doing the things that are meaningful to you. And she also said, and I don't need you to sit and watch me all day. I need time by myself. I need time to spend doing the things that I want to do and that I need to do. And so that was another decision that we made. And eventually at the end of the semester, I did have to take a few weeks off, and I missed a number of things. But, you know, I have since, you know, at times I would regret that I should have just taken the semester off. And but we didn't know whether she would live into the new year and then the next semester, what that would look like. And you don't know, you have limited days that you can shut your life down. And so you have to make decisions based on what you know at the time, and the best that you can do in a given situation, which may not be in hindsight, you know, but by reminding myself of why we made the decisions we made. So I guess my word to anybody would be to make your decisions deliberately so that when you do have these doubts, when someone's gone, you can go back and say, oh, but this is why we did this. Mm-hmm. And we did the best we could at that time.
Right. And you did it together. So in going forward, you know that it's a cohesive understanding. It's both of you working together toward an end. And I think that has to help.
Yeah. For sure.
That's all.
Well, and you both had, you know, the extended time with the chemotherapy treatments. And so you had some of that time knowing that there was an end and preparing for that. Is there anything that you learned during that time that you would give, or, you know, knowledge you would share with people who don't necessarily have a terminal diagnosis? Maybe they're just living their life, but to be prepared for the unknown or for, you know, something that comes up where maybe there won't be time, you know, a sudden death or a you know, instance where a diagnosis is much shorter.
Yeah. You know, I think you have to, I really think that life is lived, that do the best you can every day. And that sounds just like nothing really to say that. But I think if we are as intentional as we can about our lives every day, that that when someone does go quickly or without much warning, then we don't say, oh, I needed to say this and I needed to say that. I was talking to a friend last night who has a very special mentor who's going to be dying in the next week or so. And I said to him, I said, you know, I think this would be kind of like I said about my dad a few years ago. My father had been quite declining for a long time, but then there was a moment, a point where we knew he had just a few more days. Well, I went to be by his side, but I didn't get in the car and drive overnight and do something radical. I went in a normal amount of time. And I told Brenda at that time, I said, my dad and I are in great shape. We have nothing that needs to be said at the end. There is nothing that I have waited. There's no secret that needs to be revealed. We are great. He knows he's going to die. I know he's going to die. We are okay. And that's kind of what I said to my friend last night was, I don't think you have anything that she would need to hear from you or she would need to say if my read of your friendship is correct. So I think we just need to live vulnerably and transparently all the time. So if something were to happen, that we're okay with that. And I think to have those conversations sometimes, not in a morbid way, but Brenda and I had said so many times in the last 10 years, if something were to happen to us, we would have lived a life that was much bigger and grander and greater and with greater grace and blessings than either of us could have ever imagined. Mm-hmm. And we said so many times how grateful we were to get to have lived the life we lived. So I think expressing gratitude along the way, which reminded me that yes, we only had 36 years, but yes, we had 36 years and right. They were well-lived. They weren't passive years. Mm. So I think, you know, even my mother is 85 and has a number of illnesses or different things wrong with her. But we talk often that, you know, she says, I really do hope that I just one morning you call and I don't answer and I'm gone. And she said, and I'm going to be so pleased that I could die that way. Mm. And she said, if I lay there all night, don't worry about that. Or how long was I there? just be glad that I'm gone and that's okay. And, you know, we talk about these things frequently. And I think we have families, we have people, I have friends who have never had a talk about what would death look like? How would our family respond? What would you want? Where would you like to be buried? Those are important questions. And I had another family member not long ago that was ill. And it occurred to me, I don't know where we should, how we should treat his body at his death. And mm-hmm. is there anything I'm involved in terms of financial things or business interactions? And so we had this conversation, but I think to have those conversations proactively and periodically, you know, to assess and having things like your will and all those kinds of things in order. And you hear those things all the time. People talk about them, they talk about them, but we all say that's will never be me.
Right. Well, but, I think you touched on, you know, some people consider it morbid or, oh, I don't want to think about you dying. You know, we're not there yet. But, you know, I'm of the mindset you can never be too prepared. And so start having those conversations because we're not promised tomorrow. And, you know, we just don't know what's going to happen.
And you want to do what the deceased person would want. And how do you know if you don't have those conversations?
Right.
I know, too. I don't remember when you started, but you started writing in Caring Bridge to help people who were far away, like me, understand what was going on. It seemed like a really efficient way to communicate. And you were very transparent and open and honest. And that helped. I know it helped me and other friends feel like they knew what was going on and could pray specifically and could share with you in response. And that helped a lot. That's really a great forum, I think.
Yes. Yeah. At first I was just texting people and, you know, updating and that was just overwhelming me because I was constantly copying and pasting and it would just take hours and stuff. And then this friend of mine said, oh, we should set up a Caring Bridge site. And she helped set that up and put it all in motion. And then that was just the best thing ever, because then I stopped feeling like I had to post on social media and then you had to update and you had to put it in Brenda's social media and mine and on and on the list goes, you know, we just eventually let everybody that wanted to know start to move to Caring Bridge. And that was such a help. But another, the whole idea of dying as you've lived, Brenda and I dealt with infertility many years ago, 30 years before her death or so. And in those years, after a while of sort of living in the corners in a shameful kind of way, and people asking lots of very awkward and inappropriate questions about what that was like and why aren't you having a baby and you're just keep on saving your money and, you know, you might as well let some of that money go one of these days. It's just all the kinds of things people say, you know, that are not very sensitive. We decided to just put our stuff out there. So we started saying, well, we're an infertile couple and we're not able to conceive a child and we'd love to have your prayers or, you know, or just something like that. And then even after adoption, people would make very not good comments, you know, like, I guess you wouldn't know what it's like to have to, you know, pay for a child to be born at the hospital. You know? And I got to where I would say, you know, we did pay for this baby and a lot more than you would pay for a hospital bill. We did pay the hospital bill plus a lot and just kind of being open. And then even with our kids, as they dealt with issues about adoption and, you know, other children saying, you know, your mom must have left you in a trash can somewhere. And, you know, the horrible things that children will say, you know, we said, it's your place to help people not do that and to let them know the truth. So we taught our kids to tell their story and be vulnerable. And that was an example. And then when we had some challenges with our children in some of their teenage and young adult years, we also made a decision that we're not going to just go around telling everybody our pain and our story, but if someone asks, we're going to share our story. And then invariably somebody would say, oh my gosh, thank you for saying that. I have had the same experience. And so with this death, this wasn't our first example of deciding to live vulnerably and, and living openly and not being, shamed. I'm a big person on that. Shame is painful and horrible, but not being shamed or, just embarrassed or what have you, that we had valued community. And if you live in community, then you must die in community to be authentic. Mm-hmm. And death is not a private thing. I don't know why we suddenly became this country and these people where, you know, death is only about this one person. Mm-hmm. It's not that. It's a community thing. It affects many, many people. It has tentacles that go all kinds of directions. So death is something that we need to live with the input of others.
Well, and we've done some episodes about how people respond to illness and infertility and cancer and death, and some really inappropriate responses of some people. And I think if you take it, as you've said, be vulnerable, be open, I answer questions thoroughly, that's only going to help get rid of the stigma so that people learn how to respond. They learn an appropriate response because they've heard it. They've seen it modeled for them.
That's right. And you don't become annoyed so much with what people say, but you say, well, this is an opportunity for me, in a, you're saying to yourself, to help you understand right. what it is and understand how to respond, because we don't say insensitive. Most people are not mean. They're just uninformed.
You know? Exactly.
In the same way with the, you know, our kids and their friends at school, you know, these children, they didn't know, but also, you know, we talked about with our children, you know, you were not in a trash dump, but if you had, that would be okay too.
Yeah.
We didn't want to put down the child who was found and thrown away, because that child is also valuable. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you have to even go deeper sometimes in your sensitivity. One other thing that I think we talked about just a little bit here is, I think sometimes we don't always have to do exactly what the deceased person wishes either, because a few years ago, my aunt passed away and we were all together. She died on Christmas night. And so our family had always gathered on Christmas night. So we gathered at her house, sort of a vigil, and she passed while we were all there. Well, when the undertaker came to pick up her body and take her body away, they asked us all to go out on the front porch. So we have literally about 50 or 60 people. This is my mother's huge family. And we were all out on the front porch, and somebody got really weepy and started, you know, kind of sharing about her. And then somebody else said, now we're not going to cry, because, you know, Glenda wouldn't have wanted us to cry. And I said, well, I think this is the first time in our family that Glenda has not been in charge. We can do what we want to now.
Right. That's great.
And every response to death is different, right? You don't know how you're going to respond to a certain person's death. And so shame on us for thinking that the deceased has any right to determine that.
Exactly. You know, because death, how you respond really is about how you need to respond, not about how they would want you to respond. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. It makes me think of my dad, as he was declining in health. All my sisters, we would sit around and talk to him about, you know, well, what do you want for your funeral? What do you want? You know? And every time he would say, I want you girls to do what you girls need to do. I'm not going to be there. I don't need you to do anything for me. You do what you need to do for you.
But how freeing that is.
Oh, yes.
To say that to you. Well, recently my brother and I were talking about death, and he was the person that was not well. And we had these questions. And so I said, I just need to know. And I said, I hope this is not hard for you. He said, no, I don't mind talking about this. And, you know, it's okay. And then we ended up having a lot of laughs about what would happen and what he wanted to be sung at his funeral. And, you know, we just laughed a lot about it all and had a, because there were funny things about it, you know, and it's okay to laugh with people that are dying.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we did that a lot in our family.
And encouraged.
Yeah.
Like laughter can be healing, you know, it can really soothe you in a moment of, you know, disease a little bit.
Yeah.
Wow. What an awesome experience this has been. And I just know from having spoken with our listeners on several different occasions about several different things, this is going to be just a treasure trove of inspiration for people, because a lot of people facing a terminal illness, facing death, don't know what to do. They don't know how to do it. And I just can't thank you enough for your openness and your big heart and willingness to share all of this, because huge help to our listeners.
I want to add one quick thing. I know we're out of time, but it just occurs to me too, that there was a time where our children and I were really ready to see Brenda die.
Mm.
And that's something else that I think often could guilt you into a really horrible place. And we sort of all said to each other individually, you know, how do you feel about this? And we kind of then all the three of us came together and said, we are so tired and we're so weary of thinking that mom is going to die and that she's not going to get back up. And then she rallies again. And then, you know, which you're glad she rallies, but you keep on, your emotions are just going up and down.
Yeah.
And at some point we all three agreed that we're really ready for her to go. Mm-hmm. And so we spent a lot of time, as hospice people guide you, in releasing her and letting her know that we are okay for her to go and that feel free to pass at any point. We also, our hospice people were really wonderful. They said, do not sit with her all the time. Do not stay in the room with her. She needs you to leave the room so that she can go by herself.
Mm.
People often don't die on their own. So that was, even if that weren't true, it helped us not to feel that we had to sit in the room and just be there all the time, day and night. And we let her be alone and things like that sometimes. And so anyway, there's just so many things, but listening to other people's experiences, the positive ones, mm-hmm. And realizing, I think, there's a woman that said to me, the one thing I would tell you is not to leave her side until the moment she leaves. And this was like 6 months before she died, or 7 months. And I just thought, oh my gosh, you know, we're not put together like that. You know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think death is individual and it has to be crafted according to your life, and your relationship with the person who is going to be dying determines the death procedure. Yeah.
And I think that's the point, that it's mm-hmm. so individual. It's so unique to the person and to the family,
right.
That you have to, you can't make a whole lot of generalizations.
Well, and I love how you said, you know, you've said several times, you have to die like you lived. And that's how you and Brenda both chose to do that. And so it really speaks volumes of just kind of knowing who you are, and that's not your relationship, that you weren't, you know, locked, you know, hip to hip forever and every day and every minute. And knowing that that's okay, that that's how you lived your life. And so that's how you're choosing to die. And so I think that's beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, is there anything I was just, before you said that, I was going to say, anything else, you can think of that we haven't touched on, I mean, you've just given us so much, and I so appreciate it, but I don't want to leave anything out.
No, that's fine. And if we were just sitting around talking for an afternoon, there's a lot more that could be said, but I think we've said the most important things. And thank you so much for inviting me to be a part of this. I really appreciate it. And I'm honored that you asked me And it is a journey that I feel a sense of responsibility or privilege to share, because we need to be together with others and we need to have best practices for death as much as we do for life. We have so many books about how to live and very little is written about how to die.
True.
So true.
A lot is written about what to do when someone does die.
Yeah, right, right. There's something about the interim that's gone. But, it's not but there.
In that meantime, not so much, you know.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. It's just been a joy to talk and reconnect and to hear a little bit more of your story. We are so grateful for you taking some time today.
Thank you both.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Down There Aware. We are so, so grateful for Randall and his honesty and his openness and his willingness to speak to us about what is generally a very difficult topic. If you have any questions about this episode or would like to discuss further, please reach out to us on social media. We are at Down There Aware on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, all the places. And you can also reach us on our website, www.downthereaware.com. And you can always email us, downthereaware@gmail.com. Thank you again for listening to this episode. We really appreciate your support. If you feel so inclined, leave us a review on whatever platform you're listening on and give us a rating. We really appreciate that. And we will see you next time. Thanks for listening.